I'm curious, can you describe this emotional roller coaster of writing? Like, what does that look like?
I think, especially when I start, I may have some ideas. It differs, but usually, initially I start and then I hit the wall. Mm-hmm. Even though I have an idea what I want to write, but you hit the wall.
And then I have to write the research. Like, you've hit the wall after, like...
I have these two things, like, okay, I'm going to write about, say...
Sandwiches.
And then I have these two concepts, like, I'm going to write about, say, how fucked up the food industry is, and I'm going to write about the taste of pork, and I'm going to connect these together.
Yeah.
And then you start writing.
Yeah.
This is a funny example, because, anyway,
yeah.
I don't even eat meat, but... You know, like, and then start writing and you write the sentence and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like, you know how sometimes certain ideas, like, oh, this A and B, I can so easily connect.
Yeah,
and then you start writing. And that's why I love writing as a thinking process. And going through this frustration of not being able to resolve it easily, or you don't know how much time it's going to take.
Yeah.
And that I might need to read some things and go for a walk and like be stressed and then be sleepless because I'm like a night writer and then I have to wake up in the morning. So it's really kind of counterproductive a little bit. But I don't know. And then you finally hit the flow and then you write a page without much thinking and it's like amazing. And then the next day you are again in this like, oh, this is bullshit. I need to completely discard everything. Yeah, so this sort of roller coaster. And I'm thesis supervisor at... master program, and I always tell my students, like, it's not going to get better. I mean, you might train yourself as a writer that it becomes like when you do sports, you know, that you train a muscle, and if you take a break you kind of need some time to get back to the same sort of rhythm, but in I feel like in terms of the emotional roller coaster part, it doesn't get better. How do you feel about writing, because you also write quite a bit?
I find I if I hit If it's difficult, I know that I'm in the right direction. That's what I've learned. I didn't know that for a really long time. I thought there was something wrong with me, or that like I was just not going to be a writer. But actually, if I'm lying on the floor frustrated, and I literally lie on the floor and be like, why is my life so shit? Like, I now know that there is something I need to stick in that direction. Like, and also, like, if I don't have the first line, it will take me a really long time.
Right? It's so interesting. I had to beat that too.
So, like, I sometimes allow myself not to write anything until I'm like, actually, and I always write it in my head. I'm like, okay, it's going to be like salad sandwiches are good for the environment, whatever. And I'm like, okay, like, I write that down. I can now... go further. Like, I had to write a text for an artist, and I just really like I had written a lot of notes and I had a lot there, but it had no hook, in my opinion. And I was just like, and I was literally breastfeeding in the middle of the night. I'm like, I know what I'm going to write about. It just kind of came out of nowhere, which of course all the work is usually done when you're not working. Do you find
that? Yes, definitely. Shower. It's
To
be.
Probably doing the dishes.
Also.
I really like when I feel like my brain is being stretched, and that's being stretched because I have a creative problem, and I don't generally want to get pulled out of that. Even though I'm like, oh, I hate this. Like, writing sucks. Like, why am I doing this? Like, I don't actually want to be pulled out of it. I want to stay in it. And it feels like, I don't know, it feels exciting when it starts to come together.
Right.
Yeah. It's
That's when you get this flow, when you are like still a lot of work to do, but you kind of can see how it comes together. Oh, my God. That's addictive.
Yeah. Well, also, like, if I'm stuck, I usually look for music lyrics.
Music I also find quite good.
So helpful. Like, at one point, actually, I don't know when I was doing this, but there was a one point that I only listened to a soundtrack for a movie I've never seen. I can't remember what the movie's about or what it's called, but it's like a soundtrack by Mogwai and the Kronos Quartet, and it's the most dramatic soundtrack. And I used to write that only, like, for like 3 years or something.
Wow.
And like now I'm like, this is way too dramatic. I'm like, why would I listen to this? This is like, you know, because it like starts off like sort of like ominous and then it has its peak and then it goes down. Like, you know, it's like, and I would find my writing like kind of following this drama. I must have been at the Infonike when I was something like that. I really can't remember.
Interesting.
But there was no lyrics, but instrumental, cinematic.
I also like the cinematic, dramatic music, which kind of escalates and it goes on and on and on. That kind of, I like that too.
Yeah, it's like
dark.
I like to
listen to music when I write too.
Oh, well, then I'll send you my list.
Oh, please, yeah. Please. Yeah, all the other things that.
Hello everyone, we're excited to be back with the third season of I Hope This Message Finds You Well, a podcast on curating, where I, Eloise Sweetman, and my friend and colleague Chris Diddle talk to curators about their approach to curating, how they began, and what they love about the profession. In this season of the podcast, we're focusing on the topic of the exhibition.
In this episode, we talk to Henrik Walkert, curator of international contemporary art at the Moderna Museet in Stockholm. With Henrik, we talked about the ways his former experience in curating performance and public programs influenced his current curatorial practice and approach to exhibition making. He sees the exhibition as a relational mechanism manifested by his interest in scenography, staging artworks, and the way bodies move through space. Hi, Henrik. It's really nice to have you with us on a call. And I wanted to start by letting our listeners know also how we know each other, which I realized I've met you over 10 years ago mm-hmm. in Amsterdam when you were working as a curator of a public program at the Stedelijk Museum. And I was at the time still a newcomer to Amsterdam as a participant of the Apple Curatorial Program. And I recall your program of lectures and performances and events as something that was very vibrant. And I remember at the time, the events I took part at least, I went mm-hmm. to the Stedelijk almost on a weekly basis. Of course, I had a professional interest, but still it was mm-hmm. something that kept us returning to the institution. And I feel like, and please correct me if that's not true, that with your programming, despite being named as a curator of public program, your work indirectly aimed to kind of debunk this binary between performance and exhibition.
Yeah, that was a big part of the work, I think, for sure. But please continue.
And it also leads me to think about how that attitude perhaps informs your current work now, as you work as a curator of international contemporary art at the Moderna Museet in Stockholm. And I will directly jump into our first question, how you think about the exhibition, what the exhibition is for you, and how these former experiences in performance and public programming influence your approach to the exhibition.
Thank you. What a great question to start with. And before I respond, Chris, Eloise, thrilled to be here. I hope you're well too, of course. Probably not the first time someone made that a joke, but here we go. Yeah, like Chris, I really appreciate your introduction because it really leads to the sort of a question in a wonderful way, in the sense that my relationship to the exhibition as a format has always been through a sort of a performance and through sort of the event, let's say, whether that was sort of a discursive sort of an event or like a performance event or a film event. I mean, as you know, back in sort of Amsterdam, it was a really a lively time, you know, and that institution welcomed and could host that type of sort of a programming at a very unconventional moment in its history, namely when it was sort of half sort of open, half sort of closed, nomadic. It was really in this sort of a transition time. And we can talk a little bit more about that because it speaks to, kind of sort of the timing of things, which I think is always a crucial part of a curatorial practice. But You're very right in saying that my relationship to exhibition, which has, of course, evolved over the last decade, comes from that knowledge, from that working experience with sort of a performance. And I can really see that, I don't know, it's maybe so to say, I can see that like mature a little bit somehow, you know. And I'll give you an example, like, you know, one of the recent exhibitions that I've kind of realized here in Stockholm at Moderna is called Seven Rooms and a Garden, Rashid Johnson and Moderna's Musée's collection. And it's a bit of a hybrid show. Like it's a solo exhibition of Rashid and sort of Moderna Musée's holdings in relationship to each other. So it builds an art history for a solo sort of exhibition. And it gives a sort of a contemporary lens for sort of a museum to look at its own kind of sort of a collection history and the histories that it holds within that. So it's an interesting show to make, of course, and it was a great like dialogue with him. But the exhibition is quite, in lack of a better term, theatrical, in that like both Rashid and I were really interested to think in terms of like sonography and in terms of not exhibition design or sort of architecture, but really sort of sonography as a way to stage not just the work, but how the bodies move through that space and experience the art in that space. So I'm really interested in coming to exhibition and exhibition like design from that sort of a performative mode. And every room kind of articulates a stage in a certain way and thus sort of a relationship to how something is experienced and seen and sort of embodied, I think, at the end of the day. So yeah, that's one way to answer it, I guess.
What drew you to the performance and event in the first place?
Thank you. I was lucky, really, because I studied art history at the University of Amsterdam. And back then, and I'm sure a number of them are still there, but back then there was a real amazing feminist moment, actually. There was sort of Professor Cherry was sort of a chair of art history, and she was from London and really brought a strong feminist history with her. Other people like Rachel Esner, Marga van Mechelen, Miriam van Rijsingen, Sophie Berby, like a lot of my sort of professors and people that I interacted with came from some kind of like feminist school, whether that was sort of a European one or sort of an American, very heavily sort of October sort of influenced school. And so there was a lot of space to think through sort of critical theory. So a lot of space to think through sort of feminism. Queerness was articulating itself, maybe not as strongly in the world of sort of academia as it is now, but then you could definitely kind of feel it as well. So I kind of, entered that space with an enthusiasm that I think shaped the rest of what I did, because it was really like you start learning about art history immediately by like debunking it and not taking it for sort of granted and actually throwing it upside down all the time and see it for what it is and try to sort of expand it in so many ways too. But of course, the history of feminism is so related to the history of sort of a performance and sort of body art as well, as many female artists who started to work in the 60s and 70s used the body as their medium, right? That was sort of available somehow as sort of a materiality. And cutting some like sort of corners here in the history of sort of a performance art and feminism, surely, but I think that was really impactful, actually. And so after my MA in art history, I worked at the Apple Art Center, which sort of, Chris, you know really well from your own background, because that's really how we met. And the Apple Art Center has that big history in sort of a performance as well, and in feminist histories and in many other things. So yeah, it was my education. And I actually, funnily enough, because when you do art history at most sort of universities, you don't get to learn a lot about exhibition sort of practices, at least not back then. Hopefully now that they do, thinking about sort of exhibition histories. But so, yeah, I thought that was it. You know, I really didn't. I mean, that sounds a bit naive. It was not like that. But it was like, oh, yeah, sort of a performance is what you do somehow, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think around the time that you both were in Amsterdam Chrisette, De Apple, and then also you, Hendrik, at the Stedelijk was when I first moved really to Europe. And it was a really exciting moment to also see how, because I come from Perth, which is a very different place to Amsterdam in terms of cultural history and also in terms of the size of an art scene. And I remember going to some events and also participating in Chris's end of the Apple project and realizing how performance, how the event is actually really a radical mode of entering into a place that maybe as an audience you might have felt like you were not allowed to step into. It was really a very exciting moment for me, actually. It really opened my eyes to also like what you're building on, Hendrik, is also a building upon this existing history of performance and events and the happening in Amsterdam, which is so exciting, I think, to have that as a foundation to then spring on to now.
Totally. And I think, you know, that moment in Amsterdam that you're describing right now, I mean, it also stands on the shoulders of historical moments, of course, because sort of Amsterdam was such sort of a performance hub in the 60s, 70s and sort of 80s, much thanks to an organization like the Apple Art Center. And then later when sort of If I Can Dance and sort of other sort of organizations in the early arts, they sort of picked that up again. And I felt really quite sort of comfortable on the shoulders of somehow. It wasn't like, and also in that institution had a history of sort of a performance in and of itself. But maybe what I wanted to say is that in a broader, more sort of international, let's say, a perspective, it was also a bit of a renaissance for sort of a performance, you know, because a young sort of a generation of sort of artists had entered sort of the museum with sort of a performance with, you know, of course, early sort of examples being sort of a Segal or Hassabi or like Bachsetzes or many sort of artists coming from dance, actually, right, who kind of entered that visual art space and tried to like reinvent and try to understand how something that lives and moves and has a different sort of audience requirement, has a different time span, has a lot of different things, how that works and operates in that space. And I felt like I was very much also, in the aftermath of people like sort of Stuart Comer or sort of Catherine Wood at the Tate, or sort of in Europe and the States, which was very much my world at that sort of time. Yeah, there was that momentum, I guess. That's really like the right word. And then, you know, to work with artists like Sharon Hayes and like Wu Tsang and sort of Every Ocean Hughes and many, many great artists who were really thinking through that new moment of sort of performance, sort of embodiment and liveness in so many ways, and to sort of commission them in that museum that was basically like reinventing itself a little bit. Sort of the timing was just so great, you know, and you could feel that energy somehow. And why I'm interested to kind of bring that knowledge forward, because and maybe I'm being very honest here, it's not across the board, but I myself am experiencing fatigue is not really the right word, but then I'm sort of transitioning into another kind of phase almost for myself, that I understand sort of, you know, sort of showing and staging sort of, the ins and outs of sort of working sort of curatorially with sort of a performance quite well. And so I would like to sort of challenge myself, and I have been, because I've been making lots of different shows in the last year, to understand how that knowledge and sort of experience can inform really the exhibition as a format that we think we know, or that is always ripe for reinvention somehow.
I would like to return a little bit back to this exhibition that you pointed at, the Seven Rooms and the Garden, if you could tell us a little bit more about that. Also, maybe in relation to what's just been said, I'm thinking about performances most often understood as this kind of singular event. And then you mentioned the importance of scenography in the exhibition space. That's something I feel quite close to myself, and the way I think about bodies entering the space and how the encounter happens. And maybe here I want to emphasize the word of encounter, which takes the performance from the singular event into the encounter, which can happen anytime, and it's kind of ongoing thing. So this is just my thought process that went through my head right now. But I would love to hear a little bit more about how you dealt with this encounter and the scenography of this exhibition. If you could tell us a few ideas or maybe even describe a little bit the spaces.
Yeah, of course. Maybe before I do, let me explain sort of a process. Because we had a year to make this exhibition, and you've seen the scale of it because you were here not so long ago, and it's not a small show. So it was relatively done in like a fast way, actually. And it was because, again, sort of the timing was really right for both this artist, like Rashid, to think about his sort of a practice, which he always does sort of art historically, and to find those longer lines and to also like reassess certain things and open himself up to new sort of influences and like vocabularies around his work. I mean, he is solidly sort of, in the middle of, or sort of, at the peak of his sort of artistic sort of vocabulary, I think, at the moment in so many ways. And for, again, like Moderna Museet is an institution in a glorious identity sort of a crisis. So it's like really wants to think about itself and wants to reinvent itself a bit and is open to experiment. And then, me coming into that institution, because I started there in October 2021, so it's fairly recent, as someone who is eager to get to know that sort of museum and its holdings. And so, there's energy there, right, that you can like leverage towards what an exhibition can be and how it can feel and what it holds as well. So Rashid came to Stockholm in October 2022, a year before we were supposed to open. And we spent the entire days that he was there really in this space. And now that's not sort of unusual, of course, but we really, like, we circled the spaces. We went through them like over and over and over, because both he and I could notice, think through space. Like, that is how the show was made. And at the start of our day, sort of, I remember it really well, it became quite clear that we needed sort of a device, a staging mechanism, if you will, that could hold this relationality between his work and, let's say, the museum's holdings, whatever that was going to be. But we knew that it was going to be those two things, right? And for me, that's what sonography is. It's sort of a relational mechanism. You know, it sort of puts one thing there and sort of another thing there. And there can be whatever form of sort of articulation of a stage holding that relationship, right? And that really comes from sort of performance, right? That thinks about that moment and that sort of encounter somehow. And Rashid himself is not unfamiliar with using staging mechanisms in his shows. I would, he's very much thinking through that, I think, both in his actual sort of sculptural work and the way that he shows his work. And so we started in the first room, which is a room. I mean, we have seven rooms and a garden. That's really what the show is. And the first room is logically, because Rashid is an artist who's very interested in working with sort of abstraction and the many histories sort of around that. And he's an abstract sort of artist, one could argue. And so the first room was definitely going to be about sort of abstraction and what it means as a sort of a gesture to think through or to feel through or to see through, actually. And we said, okay, we need a very low stage here of like 5 centimeters high that can hold the center of the room, and that on which we can build sort of a sort of support structure that would revisit how Moderna Museet has shown its own sort of a collection of abstractions or abstract art histories. So if that is at the center, then we thought, Rashid could be off stage, because a lot of his work, I believe, has been put on stage, like, and needs to sort of perform a certain way and is expected to perform a certain way, because he's an African-American sort of artist. And that comes with a lot of sort of projections, I think, from people who enter an exhibition space of his work. And I think many artists sort of, who who kind of come from that history and that space are thinking through that at the moment. And his work has always been about insisting on a certain humanity and not to be like reduced to one thing. So it felt very natural to have this like, let's put sort of the museum on stage and the artist, let's say, off stage. I'm still in the same room, of course, and everything is equally visible. And from there, we went into all the other like 7 rooms and tried to say, okay, like the stage should never always just be a low stage of 5 centimeters high. What other forms can it take, right? And sometimes it can be a wall, or sometimes can be a piece of furniture that people sit on. Or so this stage sort of really in each room has a different manifestation. But what it always does is it puts sort of the museum on stage and sort of Rashid giving the offstage kind of space to take a breath in a way, and also to allow a multitude to happen for him instead of sort of a reduction. I'll say one more thing because I've been talking a lot now, but the other rooms, just to kind of give you a sense, the first room is about sort of abstraction. The second room is about sort of the ready-made. The third room is about sort of improvisation. The fourth room is about sort of anxiety. And I'm giving these sort of key words just to give you an impression that each room also really holds sort of a methodology that is sort of key to his work that he has been thinking through and with, but also as sort of anchor moments for our museum's history, actually. I mean, sort of the ready-made and that sort of Duchampian history is very foundational for this institution. And it's been working with that through its sort of inception in 1958. So yeah, it was really an actual dialogue, you know? And I think that's what sonography hopefully can do. And that's why I really distinguish it from exhibition design, which I think has a slightly different history and sort of architecture as a word that also is used a lot in sort of the visual arts, of course. And I'm interested actually in the coming years to understand the middle ground between these notions somehow. I haven't fully figured that out, and that's okay, I think.
I found it fascinating what you talked about and the way you work with artists. Because when we started this series or this season of the podcast, and when we were deciding about why to make a theme or our core theme or focus on the exhibition itself, we realized we both have a similar but also a very different approach to it with Eloise. And my hesitation or almost critique of the exhibition is that it very often can be a quite violent structure, that it's very difficult to get rid of its representational mode. And I think all the things you were just talking about, you know, the violence of the gaze or being presented or expected to perform in particular ways. And I think it, more often than not, it's not so much taken in consideration in many shows we see around. And so I found it quite interesting the way you described this collaboration that was quite close and working in tandem rather than, you know, inviting an artist and giving like total carte blanche, which sometimes can be a metaphor for carelessness or, you know, kind of utilizing someone's presence in one or the other way. Maybe could you tell us more how you work with artists oftentimes and how you approach the exhibition from that perspective?
Yeah. Thank you. Give me a moment to gather my thoughts, because I want to really, I'm going directly into your question, but I also wanted to say another thing about 7 Rooms in a Garden and sort of a collaboration with Rashid was also that we both had our work sort of ahead of us, you know, like he was really thinking about which work he was going to sort of bring to this structure. And I was thinking about which work we were going to sort of bring to this structure, you know. So it was actually sort of a collaborative labor in that sense, you know. And the structure of the thing, this like sonography, is something that we both then had to like relate to somehow. So I think that made it quite successful or sort of impactful at the very least. And it kind of is a segue to how I want to answer your sort of a question, because like, It takes a while in one sort of practice to articulate what you really stand for and to understand what that means, right? And it's not one thing, but one of the things that I mentioned when I sort of applied to Moderna for the job that I have now was, it was, I think, even the first sentence, like, I sort of consider my sort of curatorial practice to be sort of artist-centered. And what that means for me is that you sort of align institutional labor with artistic sort of practice instead of the other way sort of around. And that artist-centered kind of approach is something I've learned from my mentors, actually. I should give them a lot of sort of credit, like Anne Goldstein, who was a director in Amsterdam when I worked there and who also invited me to work at the Art Institute of Chicago. I was really in dialogue with her for, I don't know, 8 years, with some sort of interruptions, of course, as well. But she really understood that sort of profoundly, you know, like what artist-centered means. And it means that you think about hosting an artist in your institution on every level, from making sure that they feel welcomed when they visit to understand that you have to actually like be an interlocutor between this institution and this sort of artist and try to navigate how to maybe sort of change institutional sort of processes in order to host this artist well, you know? And so I have learned a lot from her. But for me, at this moment, it means like, okay, we never take the institutional framework as a given, you know? It is something that I do believe can and should be sort of changeable to align, hopefully, if it works out and if it goes well, with what this artist wants to realize. And that is not a carte sort of a blanche. That's not what that is, because I do agree that's too often used as an excuse for like anything sort of a goes. There is a real like dialogue happening in that moment between the museum and sort of the artist and myself in that case and sort of an artist. And it can be sharp and it can be sort of critical as well. And sometimes saying, oh, okay, we're steering away from that, or have you really thought about that? And hopefully vice versa as well. And those are usually the best sort of conditions to make a good exhibition, quite like sort of straightforwardly, but also for the institution to understand and internalize that hospitality. Because I think much of the sort of institutional sort of crises that we see at the moment with many conflicts with sort of artists. It's really, it's happening almost every day, it seems, these days, has to do with hospitality. You haven't thought about what you're actually hosting, you know? And it's a real issue, I think, because this is where it often goes wrong.
Yes. And hospitality is interesting because I feel oftentimes institutions also don't host the visitors. They provide a service, perhaps, or content. But I it's a very interesting point also to think about it this way.
And sort of to your point, because I think it's a great one and one that I neglected to mention, but I think that can unfold on so many levels as well, how to host sort of an audience, right, in the exhibition or the sort of a program that you've made. Yeah, it can really have to do from really basic things like please have seating in your exhibition because people don't want to stand all day to, yeah, also make that furniture or that seating or whatever you have a bit sort of playful. And it doesn't always have to be like a very basic bench or something. It could be other things as well somehow. To, really giving the tools for an audience, whether that happens through labels or there are many sort of tools, of course, or sort of handrails, if you will, to guide them into the world and the vision of this sort of artist that they may be getting an introduction to, you know, or maybe they know them sort of already a bit. Without being too sort of interpretation heavy, you know, I don't think our job is to interpret art for other people. They can do that just fine on their own. But there's a lot of sort of conversations happening internally as well between different sort of stakeholders, whether it's sort of education in sort of a museum or, there's always sort of a conversation about how do we sort of communicate about an artist or an exhibition towards an audience. And I think that's always what keeps the conversation in museums so alive. And that's why I still really believe in these institutions too, despite God, all their faults, and we can talk about that too.
But I think what you were saying earlier about providing the exhibition space as a place also to breathe, or a breathing space, I think having breathing room, I think is also a really interesting idea, that also in the museum context, to be able to actually use the exhibition in this way. Because I think we know there's this kind of expectations of artists to perform in a particular way, but to also be constantly producing. There's always a newness, go, go, go. But then to also have this, okay, like, let's also offer that to the artists. But I guess what you're doing through the scenography is also offering a certain kind of breathing space or breathing room for the audience to be able to take in different modes of, like, maybe were you thinking about an emotional space, or like, how, like, what were you hoping for each room?
No, it really started by, of course, as it should, I hope, and as I often have to remind myself sometimes as well, by sitting with and spending a lot of time, in this case, with Rashid's work. And especially one recent film of his is Black and Blue from 2021. It's a short film. I think it's about 8 minutes. And it was made during the pandemic, kind of like lockdowns. And there's, I'm saying that because almost the entire film, with maybe one exception, is shot inside, in sort of the domestic space, in a home, really. And it's his own home. Or let's just say he plays a sort of a protagonist that is inhabits his home. I think that's the best way to say it. And it's very straightforwardly said, it's a very uneventful film, actually. Like, not much happens. You know, like, he wakes up, Rashid, he goes about his day. We see him sitting with his family. And this extremely unspectacular, uneventful situation allows you, actually, like, forces you to look at all the details, to take in sort of the domestic space as an artistic space, actually, which has such a beautiful, like, feminist history as well, of course, right? But okay, that's more like a side note. And to look at all the details of and they can be so minute and yet so meaningful, right? Like how someone looks at his son, or sits on the couch, or walks outside. And of course, he plays with expectations there, because I, as a white sort of person looking at this film, have a certain expectation of seeing a sort of a black man in his home. It's usually something bad is about to happen, right? And he definitely, like, there's a layer in there that sort of, let's say, sort of confronts me in this case with that gaze. You know, this is how we've been sort of programmed to look at this. And nothing happens, right? It's this intentional sort of anti-climax. What does happen are these interstitial sort of reveries, these scenes that happen like every 2 minutes. And they're this sort of layering. And he gives almost like an encyclopedia of his a practice in these moments. It's really like flashes almost. Flashes of sculptures that he's made, books that he's reading, images that he's looking at. This 8 minute long film holds his entire practice. And so the film was a starting point, because we said, how can we make an exhibition that does like three things, that maybe explores sort of the possibility of an exhibition feeling a bit like a home, like a space where you can just like sometimes wander and be and like breathe, let's say, in a different way. And of course, you know, we go in and out of that in the show. You know, we have an actual sort of bedroom. Okay, that's maybe the most literal way that we go into that. And other times it's more like subtle, of course. Secondly, I think, how can we build an exhibition where Rashid sort of Johnson, as an artist, is not reduced to something, but expands towards something, you know? And that was really also the reason to look at his work in relationship to our holdings, and to insist on a different mode of sort of address in labels, in sort of a communication, in many aspects of the show and the like sonography as well, that would not reduce but open up actually, and insist on that detailed and rich and multifaceted like humanity ultimately that he is showing in a work like sort of Black and Blue and actually many of his other works. And then thirdly, it was about me bringing a book to him actually after I had seen that film, which was Sovereignty of Quiet by Professor Kwashi, who is a scholar at Brown University. And this, his articulation of the quiet is very much what Rashid, in a way, has been doing of in his work, to find a space of detail, a space where bodies, different bodies, can be approached in like different ways. And sort of this notion of the quiet, yeah, became a very rich lens to think through, both for Rashid, I think, or I know because he's told me, and myself in the show. So there were real moments of sort of a connection. And I think, yeah, I mean, you have to, before you invite an artist, think a little bit ahead about what that person might need and what a next step could be and how you can facilitate that as like sort of a museum in my case.
Cool. Sounds amazing. I wish I had a chance to see it. As you're talking, I'm looking at the photos on the website and it feels like I've definitely missed an opportunity there. It's beautiful.
Well, not quite yet. I mean, the show is, I can do a shameless like sort of a plug now, I guess. The show is open until September.
Oh, September. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, until September. So there's going to be this beautiful overlap between Vaginal Davis, which is an exhibition that opens in May, and like Rashid, so you can see both Vaginal Davis and Rashid Johnson. I mean, I'm happy to make a segue to Vag's show because I think it also like speaks a little bit to some of the things that we've been discussing.
Okay, great. That would be wonderful.
So Vaginal Davis's exhibition, which I'm working on now, so my head is right in the middle of it, you know, it opens on May the 17th, so a few months ahead. There it became especially important for me to ask the sort of a question of hospitality again. How does this institution host this artist? And what shape must the exhibition have? And thirdly, well, what does she need, really? You know, just to put it really sort of bluntly. And three things became really clear, like, Vaginal Davis, just for those of you who might not know her, is sort of a punk, queer sort of icon from Los Angeles who came into the Los Angeles, or actually who made the Los Angeles sort of a homocore scene a thing in the late 1970s, and with her sort of art bands like Cholita, PME, sort of a Black Fag, many, of course, the Afro Sisters, yeah, kind of established sort of punk, sort of queer, sort of underground in LA in the 1980s, sort of particularly. And then in the 90s went on to sort of organize or sort of co-organize these very foundational sort of club events, sort of a performance club. It was not one thing, it was many things. Every Sunday, for instance, was Club Sucker at Garage in Silver Lake. So every Sunday evening, Vaginal Davis would host, organize, and MC this sort of event, really, of music, of bands, of like sort of performances, of sort of a party, of sex, of everything, you know? And it was really wild, I think. I mean, I was not there, but if I look at sort of the documentation and I fantasize about that, of course. It must have been quite something. it is iconic. And then many other things. I mean, she was a filmmaker, a visual artist, first and foremost, actually a writer as well. You know, she was writing for the LA Weekly and the LA Reader and started to write fiction and yeah, all kinds of things. Moved to Berlin in 2005. And because Los Angeles punk queer I don't know, in a way ended, you know, like Silver Lake, where it all happened, became such a sort of a gentrified space. And yeah, things were pushed out. LA was sort of a shifting, and maybe not in a fantastic way. Berlin was a much more hospitable sort of environment for an artist like Miss Davis. And because a scene was built there yet again, right? Like Berlin in that time, I think, as maybe we have experienced, was quite an exciting space, and to some extent still is, for people who don't fit in. Let's just put it that way. So yeah, she sort of continued the work there and has now iconic status as far as I'm concerned. But the annoying thing is, and I myself am guilty of that even, because this is not the first time that I've shown her work. I've also shown her in Chicago and Documenta 14. I sort of co-hosted her with Victor Neumann and Paul Preciado for sort of a lecture, sort of a performance. And that when she's shown, usually a small part of her sort of a practice is shown. They would show her films or maybe a lecture, sort of a performance, or sort of the paintings, but never the practice, like the whole thing, including her as a writer and as an organizer and all these different things. And that's a challenge, of course. And by no means am I saying that the show that we're making is a survey show, because that would take a lifetime, I think, to be honest. She has done too much. But it is a large-scale engagement with this sort of practice. And when I started thinking about this show or this sort of exhibition, two things became clear. First, like we would not be able to do this by ourselves. The museum can't hold all of this, and that's okay, you know? We are not sort of alone in a city, thank God, you know? So there's other sort of organizations that we can reach out to, which I'll talk a bit more about. And secondly, Miss Davis's sort of a practice is so radically like decentered, you know, it has moved to all these different spaces and has truly embraced sort of a queerness as a form in every respect sort of imaginable. So in order to centralize that within a museum feels counterintuitive, you know what I mean? Like that would be violent in a way. You can't do that. And it's a bit of an awkwardness to think about, like, the musealization, if that's even a word, of this sort of a practice to begin with, because it's punk, it's anti-institutional in so many ways, you know? So there's lots of sort of a consideration. So I felt in order to do this somehow a bit okay, I needed to build an infrastructure that was multi-venue, you know, that we could host an exhibition that would show an arc somehow, but that we would move into these other spaces in the city, some more sort of alternative and small scale, some even more institutional than we are, just to show sort of the contrast as well sometimes. And so it's this 5 or 6 venue exhibition, actually, you know, and that was the structure that I sort of proposed to Miss Davis. And, you know, of course, at first a little bit reserved about the scale of things, because it's not a small thing that you're sort of proposing, right? Like, oh, do you want to do this humongous sort of a project and give up everything that you do in the next like 2 years? But I think, I mean, we will see, knock on wood, but I think it's going to be interesting and very much building on the experiences that I've had in other sort of curatorial spaces of trying to understand a museum in an ecology of things rather than as a discrete entity.
I was about to say, like, it's interesting to think about this infrastructure that is in the city of institutions of different scale, or perhaps some maybe don't even like to call themselves as institutions. I don't know. But I was wondering also, like, are then these events or collaborations with these other institutions event-based, or is it mostly the kind of an exhibition that expands into the city? Or how is the kind of configuration of different things?
Precisely. I could give you some details. So as I said, like Moderna Museet shows a bit of an arc somehow. So we begin with sort of early films and we end with some recent work, actually. and people can really get an introduction to the sort of air practice. At the National Museum, which is kind of like the Rijksmuseum a little bit, it's this more sort of encyclopedic sort of institution that houses a collection from the 14th century until mid 20th century. A really great opportunity to do two things, sort of the paintings or a selection thereof, of course, because she's made hundreds. So we're showing 30 of them in the space of a broader art history, because I think often these sort of queer artists are also like singled out, you know, like as if, and of course they are unique and they come from a space and time, but they're not isolated. They don't work in sort of isolation. So I think for Miss Davis to, who's made these sort of beautiful sort of icon-like sort of paintings, is a beautiful museum to show her in relationship to other sort of icons, actual icons, I mean, you know, from the 14th century or something, or in relationship to different articulations of like femininity that, that she's obviously sort of interested in, whilst also in the old library of the museum, which is this really like, I don't know, ornate library. It's like gorgeous, you know, and she loves libraries. Like she loves libraries because she spent her youth in these structures. She loves to read and she's a writer, right? So she's making a new installation there based on her lifelong fascination with sort of the Wizard of Oz. And so she's re-narrating the Wizard of Oz through new sculptures and sort of audio pieces and a new zine of, as well, which she has sort of made so many of in her life. Jonathan Berger, who's an artist in his own right, has been in long sort of a collaboration with Miss Davis, and he's really sort of curating that part, actually. So he, because again, like not being able to do this alone is sometimes a very good thing, you know, not only with these institutions, but also with people in Miss Davis's world who's been with her for decades sometimes. And who have sort of contributed and been part of what she does in such beautiful ways. So that's the National Museum, so sort of paintings in a larger art history and this Wizard of Oz kind of new installation. Then people are invited to go to INDEX, Swedish Foundation for Contemporary Art, which is a smaller, more sort of independent space, very much a research space as well, and thus a great opportunity to invite an audience to take a deep dive into Miss Davis as a writer. So we've been sort of collecting a lot of her writing, almost everything, I think, and are making sort of a library there that will also be actively used as an educational sort of a tool for the art school and for other sort of student sort of opportunities in the city. Accelerator at Stockholm University is Stockholm's most, its youngest exhibition space. It's a beautiful space, kind of university sort of gallery type of model, really. So it's very strongly sort of embedded in that student, let's say, a community. They will present an installation of the Cheap Performance sort of a collective, which is a collective that Miss Davis has been a part of since the early 2000, and much like Miss Davis, like metabolizing her own histories in these new installations, they're also building a new installation that show parts of their history, because to show it all, that would be a complete like large scale exhibition in its own right. But yeah, to draw people into the sort of a practice, I think, and sort of achieve and what it is and what it was will happen in that moment. So those are the exhibition formats. And then we have a number of sort of venues that we're working with more in sort of event-based spaces, such as MDT, which is a theater next to us. There is, of course, Tensta as well, which is a sort of art space kind of in the northwest of sort of Stockholm. And there we will sort of close the whole thing off with sort of a festival type of thing. But maybe I shouldn't say too much about that because we're meeting Miss Davis on Monday to actually talk about that. So But so, yeah, so it's different sort of types of structures as well.
It sounds so wonderful that Vaginal Davis's work is like pushing the limit of all of these spaces and like it's almost an outpouring into these spaces. And how, because we're one of the questions we really have been asking ourselves and in these interviews is, what is the limit or what is the potential of the exhibition? And what I feel like you're telling us in both the examples that you've just given of the two shows that you've just mentioned is like what is really the potential to push the exhibition to beyond its limit to another point.
Yeah.
And and that also kind of using the city in this way to like dedicate the work of Vaginal Davis is kind of an amazing thing to do. I have to say, it sounds very exciting.
No, it hopefully will be. I mean, of course, I'm horribly nervous about it, but it will hopefully be a a beautiful thing. And
No, but I think your approach is so interesting, though, also to see what the limit of the exhibition of the infrastructure of one place, and also to turn that into the potential of collaborating with other spaces, and also to understand what other spaces could do maybe a bit better than other spaces, and celebrate the strengths of these. It's a very I don't know what the right word is that I'm looking for. It's not collaborative, but it's quite a generous approach, yeah. I think.
Thank you. But I think what has also happened, that sort of enthusiasm and, let's say, generosity has been reciprocated, because what I hoped would happen has happened, namely that all these institutions or spaces, let's say, that we work with, they're making their own shows with her, you know, and in a real way. Like this, I am not sort of creating these shows. I mean, I am there in dialogue, of course, you know, but it's not me sort of creating in their spaces. And I think that's really amazing, actually.
Yeah.
Because that's, and I start to realize that very strongly in sort of the last few weeks, and something that I actually want to spend a little bit more time thinking about, like, okay, what has actually happened here, you know, because it's not self-evident that would happen, you know, because sometimes these institutional sort of collaborations, they can feel sort of opportunistic even, or performative or whatever, you know, and that has not happened here. And I think that is really, that's what I think is already quite special.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I feel like from my observations, if I may say it that way, that curatorial work, as we understood it maybe 10 years ago, is shifting in a way called how collaboration is approached, and also when it comes to risk-taking. Because I feel like what you're doing is also quite much risk-taking, and perhaps this comes from the performance background as well. But I feel overall there is more attention to collaborations, and not for the kind of strategic reasons or collaboration where it is understood that we are here all thinking of the same thing and wanting the same thing, but rather in this kind of giving up of some of the control that before would be taken for granted that it's a kind of curatorial job, or that you would curate. Like, I instinctively thought that you would curate all these other spaces. So I think it's also fascinating that there is this openness emerging from your side, but also from these partner institutions.
Exactly.
Side.
Like from all sides, actually, you know, and that can only happen with a certain level of, let's say, a trust, I think, and that needs to be built, you know, and that's of course still building, and one should never betray it. But I think that like relinquishing of like a control, as you said it, I was thinking like it's really one of the most essential aspects of practicing institutional sort of a critique from within an institution. You know, and I think that's also what our sort of a generation and artists that we work with as well. It's a different relationship to institutional sort of a critique than we might know it from the 60s or 70s or the 90s. And something has shifted there. And I think there's a lot of writing about this at the moment. But it happens also within these institutions. And there is also a lot of sort of a care and love for these institutions, and try to understand sort of a change as a porous sort of a process. But that's a bit abstract and vague. I guess what I was trying to say is that it has to do most certainly with giving up sort of a control. Because as soon as institutions double down on that, which I have also seen, and is something also why I left certain sort of places, that it becomes a bit ugly, you know? And it becomes this very like restrictive like framework that you actually don't want to operate in.
I was wondering about you having worked in a few museums, how you also working in these different institutions, you inherit their collections. And I wonder how do you approach that in these various institutions, perhaps nowadays, how you look at the collection at Moderna Museet and how can you work with that? I had the opportunity to work with museum and private collections throughout my work practice, but I think it's very different when it's really your inheritance or that you carry this responsibility about a collection, whereas when I'm brought in as a freelancer to freshen up an institution's look at their collection. So I was just wondering, I would like to hear a little bit about museum collections from you.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, maybe an orthodox way to say it is take Documenta 14 as a starting point, which is, you know, I was part of Adam Shimshik's sort of a curatorial team between 2014 and 2017 when the exhibitions happened in Greece and Germany. Of course, Documenta is not a sort of a collecting institution, but it is the Museum of 100 Days. And that's how it historically has been like referred to. And so it's sort of a collection legacy is its own institutional history, I guess, in so many ways. And I think much of the sort of a project that we were undertaking at the time, which would be a sort of a conversation in and of itself, so maybe we don't have so much time to go into that. But it was, in brief, trying to understand Documenta's history in relationship to sort of a Germany, and in turn in relationship to sort of the formation of sort of a Germany as an imperialist sort of a project as well. And so, I mean, I'm really like summarizing it brutally. And I think why I'm taking that as an example, because whatever space you step into will have a certain history or legacy, of course. And I think it's important to, yeah, of course, have an understanding of that, but also relate to it, you know? Even if it's like dismissing it, like, okay, it's a new day, that was all very nice, but now we're doing something else. Or to build on it or to take aspects from it. And I think working with a sort of a collection speaks to that, right? Because in many ways, that is, for a museum, the institutional history, right? You can sometimes see who worked at a museum and who acquired what. It's individuals making suggestions and sort of proposals. And that's the intensity of it. That's the beauty of it. That's the violence of it as well. You know, that's how sort of a change can happen or sometimes hasn't happened as well, right? I mean, my work at the Art Institute of Chicago, where I started in 2017, was my first time really fully working with a sort of a collection. So, and I've been spoiled rotten because, you know, since at the Art Institute and like Moderna, those are two really amazing sort of a collections, actually. So if anything, I feel like, I don't know, a responsibility. To be honest, you know, it's really like, oh, this, all these people have worked hard to build these art histories. And some of them might not be as interesting to me now as they were to them back then. And that's totally okay, you know, but they're absolutely there and they stand firm and they might sort of come back to me at like a certain point. But to at least profoundly understand the responsibility, what it makes to make new histories within that space. And so I try to go in this work with some sort of intent, of course. Like, for instance, one of the things that I set out for myself loosely, you know, it's not something I look at sort of every day, but I would like to build a space for sort of queer sort of histories within Moderna's holdings. And I've been doing that. I've been sort of acquiring certain sort of artists. The sort of exhibition with Vaginal Davis is a part of, you know, like it all speaks to each other, of course. So I think hopefully that will be a nugget within this amazing sort of a collection that people can appreciate in like whatever span of time. And there are others, of course. So I think yeah, leveraging one expertise and trying to actively, yeah, activate that towards building a new history is a really important part of that. Oh my God, have I answered your question? I feel like I haven't.
Yeah, you have. I think it does speak to it, definitely. Yeah.
It's very inspiring, I have to say. It's very exciting. We can end it here and say thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
For your time and for your interest in joining us in this conversation and sharing your really wonderful practice and also sharing insights about the artists that you've been working with.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. We will be back with another episode in 2 weeks. If you have feedback, we'd love to receive your email at ihopethismessagefindsyouwell@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at ihopethismessage and find us on SoundCloud under the same handle.
The jingle was made by artist Natalia Sozano. Sound engineering was done by Nick Thomas. And our graphic designer is Christoph Klarais. And as you know by now, we've launched our first I Hope This Message Finds You Well t-shirt based on Christoph Klarais' design. And you can purchase our t-shirts via Everpress, linked in the show notes below.
I hope this message finds you well. I hope this message finds you well. I hope this message finds you well.